Okay, and we are back. Welcome back from intermission, for lack of a better phrase. We are going today to talk about politics, because that's, you know, the area that I'm streaming in, at least on Twitch, and so we at least have to touch on those topics. We can't spend the whole time talking about Satan and Jay-Z and conspiracy theories thereof, as much fun as that stuff can be, at least to look at from a distance from my perspective. I can't get too far into it because it starts to get a little weird, but we eventually have to get back and we have to kind of ground ourselves and remember where reality is, or at least material, physical reality. And of course, today is a holiday. As of 2 days ago, June 19th, also known as Juneteenth, is the newest federal holiday. And of course, we can't do anything in the United States without controversy anymore. And so despite the fact that the bill creating the new federal holiday of Juneteenth received overwhelming bipartisan support in both houses of Congress, I believe only 14 House Republicans voted against it, there's still controversy. So, for example, Candace Owens, always one to produce interesting controversy, said that she's not going to celebrate Juneteenth. She's just going to celebrate July 4th. And somebody came back to say, well, you know, if it wasn't for Juneteenth, then you'd be a slave and there'd be nothing for you to celebrate on July 4th. And we do things like quote Frederick Douglass saying, what does July 4th mean to an American slave? It's just another tradition in America in which he, the slave, has no part. But what I want to do is take things in a little bit of a different direction. Because, frankly, as far as slavery is concerned, we've been there and done that. We already figured out the whole slavery thing. And welcome back to the stream, Democratic Fascist. I look forward to hearing your take on all of what we'll be talking about this afternoon. So, Juneteenth is supposed to be the celebration of the end of slavery. And yet, as these particular lawmakers point out, there is still what they call a loophole in the Constitution that allows for, if not outright slavery, then at least a form of involuntary servitude. So this comes to us from the Associated Press and was published in the Washington Post. So let's take a look at this. Lawmakers mark Juneteenth by reviving this abolition amendment. So as the nation this week made Juneteenth a federal holiday, honoring the end of the enslavement of black people, lawmakers are reviving calls to end a loophole in the Constitution that allowed another form of slavery, forced labor for those convicted of some crimes, to thrive. But I do want to address this question here in the chat from Nightmare before we move too much into this. A Nightmare says, what would interest me is how she came to be as an aura consultant. So what brought her to those views? Well, you know what, Nightmare? She comes on every week. That is a regular segment that we do so we can talk about all the weird stuff that's out there. Because if it's weird, if it's a conspiracy, if it involves aliens or Hitler is alive in Argentina still, or Elvis with Bigfoot is in a UFO, she knows about it. And so if you stick around, she comes on every week at 2:30, 30 minutes after we start the show. We did a very long segment with her this week because my interview guest is coming on tomorrow. So also tomorrow at 4 p.m. New York City time, we'll be having Manuel Galvan, who is a PhD student at UNC Chapel Hill, who will be coming on to talk more about racial inequality, so on and so forth. But if you have more questions for Bianca, show up here 2:30 p.m. Eastern Standard New York City time, and you can ask her whatever questions you want about how she became to be an aura consultant and how she arrived at the views she currently has, and look forward to a roller coaster of an answer. So anyway, to get back to the topic at hand. So we're talking about Juneteenth, and we're talking about lawmakers marking Juneteenth by reviving this abolition amendment. So, the 13th Amendment to the Constitution prohibits involuntary servitude, except, that's kind of a key concept there, no involuntary servitude except as punishment for a crime. And these lawmakers are saying that this essentially leaves the door open for a continuation of slavery, which to my way of thinking is a little much, but they do have a point. And I wish that Spankin' the Monkey was still around, because the question that he asked earlier on, we're finally going to get to actually talk about that here now, almost 2 hours later. But whatever. So anyway, there's a loophole in the Constitution that allows forced labor for those convicted of crimes to thrive. So Oregon Senator Jeff Merkley and Georgia Representative Nikema Williams reintroduced legislation on Thursday to revise the 13th Amendment, which bans enslavement or involuntary servitude except as a form of criminal punishment. That exception, which has been recognized since 1865, has led to the common practice of forced prison labor. Now, if you are a longtime viewer of this show, you will remember an interview that we did months ago with Tana Ganeva, who's a Rolling Stone writer. She also writes for The Intercept. And her whole thing was police reform and criminal justice reform. And we talked there, and she's my kind of main source for most of the information I'm about to spew forth here. She talked about forced labor in prisons. So there's voluntary labor in prisons, where you can get a job and you get paid or you get special privileges because of your job. And from what I understand, those jobs are pretty jealously guarded. Like if you are the kitchen guy or the janitor guy, all your little special privileges that you get, you are very protective of those, because in the world of life in prison, those little privileges can't be got any other way. And so once you've got a hold of them, you will defend them, apparently violently, if necessary. But this is talking about something very different. This is talking about coerced labor, which, for example, in Texas, is not paid. These are prisoners who just have to go do work against their will, perhaps. So, social justice advocates say that this forced prison labor created generations of black families touched by mass incarceration and poverty, and that the ramifications are still being felt today. Now, I have a big problem with this sentence, but I'm not going to say it yet, because we're going to get to it. I want to read the rest, and then we'll talk about why, although I'm in agreement that forced prison labor is probably a bad idea. In fact, it's definitely a horrible idea, that it's not the case that this is a black issue. This is not a race issue. So Juneteenth seemed like the appropriate time to address this, quote, huge piece of systemic racism in the middle of our Constitution, Merkley told the Associated Press. Now, it is correct what they're going to say here, that this loophole in the 13th Amendment, combined with the black codes of the post-Civil War era, allowed governments in the South to arrest black people for very minor crimes and then put them in jail and force them to do labor, essentially funneling them back into a system of slavery. However, this misses the main point, or misses the point, I guess, that even to this day, prison labor goes on, but in no way is it limited to black people. In no way is this a problem that only affects black people or only affects brown people or yellow people or white people or any other color of people that you can think of, because all of us are subject to arrest. And just by the way, there's a lot of white people in prison. There's frankly a lot of every kind of person in prison, because there's huge numbers of people in prison in the United States. 5% of the world's population and 25% of the world's prison population means there's a ton of people in prison here. And it means that many of those people are going to be forced to do labor, where these forced labor things exist. Now, in the article, they say, well, you know, if you look at it, then the black and brown people tend to get the harder jobs, but the white people tend to get the easier jobs, like running the library, so on and so forth. That changes nothing about the fact that what this system does, and what's really wrong with this system, is that it creates an economic incentive to fill the prisons we arrest more people, put more people in prison for longer periods of time, allows us to, as Dan Stewart points out here, lease out convicts. Hey, we've got this great labor force that we can lease out at pennies on the dollar relative to what anybody else can offer. And all we have to do is bring to bear the power, the coercive power of the state to make this viable by arresting more people. So we're going to arrest more people. We're going to give people longer prison sentences. And we're going to hire politicians as the Corrections Corporation of America or any other lobbying association. We're going to buy politicians to go out in public and talk about the dangers of crime and we have to fight the drug war and so on and so forth. When really the economic incentive, the governing principle that drives human behavior is to create as large a prison workforce as possible. That's the real issue. The real issue is not racism. Racism might play a role, but it's not the operative factor. Racism is not the key thing here. This right here is an everybody issue, not a black people issue. Though it definitely affects black people. And I'm not here to discount racism or say it doesn't exist or anything like that. I'm here to say that I could very well end up doing prison labor. You could very well end up doing prison labor, unless you don't live in the United States. Then who knows what you're likely to experience. So this, that outlines what I've already talked about. And so this is where this issue goes off the rails here. This is the AP writing this. The issue is important to Williams, Nikema Williams from the Georgia representatives. It's important to her, a black woman who grew up in the South. What's the implication there? That if she wasn't a black woman, that this issue would be meaningless? That because I am a white man, this issue means nothing to me? Oh, I don't care. It wouldn't happen to me because I am white. I don't know about that. I drive around here and I live, you know, outside the city. There's cops everywhere. I see people getting arrested. Probably for smoking weed or something like that. Burglary, whatever. The cops are still very much around here, and mass incarceration still very much affects everybody. She hoped this legislation won't be viewed through the prism of money and what the loss of prison labor would mean. There's no other way to look at it. Because this is what I just pointed out. This is all about economic incentives. You've created an economic incentive. You've created a way for people to make money by arresting and incarcerating people. And that causes like mission drift on the part of the criminal justice system. The criminal justice system is supposed to be about justice and criminals, not about finding ways to make money for private prison corporations by leasing out their convict labor. She's trying to make this a racial issue. And I would hope that this issue would not be viewed through the lens of race, but would instead be viewed through the lens of we've created an absolutely horrifying economic incentive. So let's take a break and see what all of you are saying here. So Nightmare says, so only black people have to do forced work in prisons. Actually, no, pretty much everybody does. And then Wiznauto, I still don't know how to say your name, says all Nikes that are wrong on manufacturing lines goes to, oh, all Nikes that come out wrong from the manufacturing line end up in prisons. So you could almost say that the Nikes have been sent to prison for being wrong. I know that's not what you're saying, but you get the point. And then Dan Stewart says the U.S. has both the world's largest prison population and the highest incarceration rate. That is correct. And I think the takeaway here is that maybe one of the reasons we do, not the only reason, but one of the reasons, is that there's an economic incentive here, that prison is profitable. And so I break with a lot of other free market types in saying that private prisons are an absolutely horrible idea because you're leasing out the coercive power of the state, which is bad enough as it is, but creating ways for people to make money off of it. But listen to the way they talk about this. Quote, our people have already been in chains and enslaved because of money, Williams said. quote, we have to make sure that we are truly moving forward and not using money as a crutch of why we're continuing to perpetuate sins of our nation's founding and our nation's history. We can't get away from the fact that slavery continued to exist, not because America hated black people so much, but because slavery was highly lucrative. If it was less lucrative, it would have been much easier to get rid of. But that's beside the point. And so what I want to continue with here is to move on to this next piece, to continue to kind of make this point here. So the problem here is this. We take issues that are economic in nature or that are about justice in general, and we turn them into race issues, right? Like I said at the beginning of this episode, at the very, very beginning, the Juneteenth, insofar as it's a celebration of the end of slavery, is a fantastic holiday. The end of slavery is awesome because so many societies throughout so much of history practiced slavery to the point that you have Roman senators writing letters to each other commenting on the fact that these German tribes in the far north of Europe are so primitive and so stupid that they haven't even figured out how to have slaves yet. It was remarkable to these Romans that they could run into a society that did not practice slavery because every society, as far as they knew, practice slavery. And as it turns out, most societies through most of history have had some kind of slavery. And the United States has our own unique version of it, right? White people and black people. But everybody had it. Most of the time it was if you lost a war, then you would get enslaved. And the ancient Greeks had a whole moral system worked out around this. In fact, it's in Aristotle. Aristotle talks about natural slaves. Natural slaves are people who cannot make decisions for themselves and in fact would be better off if they were slaves. And how do you know who's a natural slave and who's a natural master? Well, if natural slaves and natural masters go to war with each other, the natural masters will win. Therefore, the Greek system, the ancient Greek system of if you lose a war, you end up as a slave, according to Aristotle, just made sense. But we have become enlightened enough to see beyond that and to say, you know what? We prefer to live in a society where people are equal before the law. Or at least we prefer to live in a society that strives, however imperfectly, toward that aspirational goal. And so Juneteenth, the celebration of the end of slavery in the United States, represents a major step forward in the moral progress of our society. It represents the end of a great evil. But we continue to take economic issues today and turn them into race issues. And as I've commented on this show before, the best way to make an issue more difficult to deal with, the best way to make sure that people approach an issue not from the wise prefrontal cortex part of the brain, but from the animalistic and emotional amygdala part of the brain, is to start turning things into tribal warfare. And by the way, the human brain, because of its structures, like the amygdala, is primed to look at someone's face. And before I remember their name or anything about them, that reptilian, maybe not reptilian, but that deep evolutionary, very old part of the brain says friend or foe, in group or out group, a member of the tribe or not a member of the tribe. So guess what? When you turn issues into white people versus black people, and I'm a white guy and I see a black guy, that a little emotional part of my brain is much more likely to start looking at the black guy and going, oh, he's a member of the other tribe, not a member of my tribe. And humans are capable of tremendous generosity and self-sacrifice on behalf of members of our tribe. When it comes to members of the other tribe, some other tribe, we are capable of tremendous cruelty. In fact, more cruelty than any other creature on the planet, because we're smarter and we have empathy, which means that I can look at you and say, I know what would hurt and terrify and utterly destroy me, and I'm going to do it to you, because you're a member of the other tribe, and so it's okay. And so we end up with stuff like this. We end up turning this economic issue or an issue of a lack of justice or an issue of a corrupt criminal justice system, and we turn it into an issue of white people versus black people, which, for reasons I've just outlined, is the worst possible thing we could do. And it leads to us coming up with these half-baked solutions like, oh, I got an idea. The police are shooting too many black people, so we'll put a black guy as the police chief. Even though, if you do just a little bit of research on this topic, even among people like Alex Vitale, the author of The End of Policing, who's a big defund the police, even abolish the police guy. It says on the front of his book, the problem is not police methods, it's not police training, it's the policing itself. Even that guy says, look, hiring more black officers, having black police chiefs does nothing. It is statistically insignificant. Statistical value zero when it comes to reducing police violence, reducing police brutality, reducing mass incarceration. The result of having a black police chief is zero. But unfortunately, the county, as this article says, where Ahmaud Arbery was slain, hires a black police chief. As if that's going to do anything. Let's take a look at the chat real quick. So, where was I? Dan Stewart says, nowhere on earth does a person have a greater chance of going to prison and staying there longer than right here in the land of the free. Dan Stewart, you love pointing that out, but fortunately it's clever enough that it bears repeated pointing out. So thank you for that. And the word slave derives from Slavic slavery. Now, I don't remember where the Slavs were slaves, but it was somewhere in Europe at some point. So, and then Nightmare says approximately 15% of the population of Rome, the city, were slaves in the year 50 BC, for example. Frankly, Nightmare, I know what you're talking about. I thought it was closer to 30%, but I suppose reasonable minds can differ on this because the point remains the same. And Dan Stewart says, even the Bible instructs the Jews to take slaves. Right. And then Dan Stewart says, oxytocin makes people feel warmly towards people they know, but it makes people distrustful and hostile toward strangers. See Sapolsky. Right, exactly. Yes, Sapolsky is actually S-A-P. I'll put it in the chat. So if you want to look this up, he's a great behavioral biologist, but that's not how you spell his name. I just put it in the chat. And In Philosopher says there's also prisoners who choose to go back to prison by offending instead of rejoining society. I think that would be relevant data somehow. Granted, I can't put this idea together entirely right now, respective to labor. Well, frankly, I think those are two completely separate issues, but you do make a good point. And that good point is this. Once I go into prison, I am in a society inside the prison that has a very different set of values and a very different set of practices than the outside world. And if I spend long enough there, I become acclimatized to that environment. But the rules in that environment do not serve me well in the outside world. The rules, especially if I go to one of these higher security prisons where there's a lot more interpersonal violence, right? We're not talking about the federal camps where they send the guys who cheat on their taxes. I'm talking about the level 3, the level 4, higher security ones, which, by the way, is where Ross Ulbricht is, the Silk Road guy. They stuck him in a maximum security prison, even though I think starting the Silk Road counts more like as white-collar crime. Neither here nor there. Point being, once I've been acculturated to that, I'm no longer acculturated to the outside world. And so getting into the outside world can be overwhelming because I've lived in these little spaces in prison and now I'm in the wide world. The culture is completely different. And by the way, I may be suffering significant trauma, even PTSD, from the high level of interpersonal violence and mistrust that exists in these institutions. And so even if there is forced labor, if that's what I'm used to, then I'll take that over the overwhelming, frightening, and confusing outside world. I'd rather go back and hang out with my buddies where I understand how things work because I spent 20 years there than go out into this other world where suddenly they don't just serve food, where I don't just have a place to sleep, where things, specific things are expected of me and I don't know how to deal with them. Can you imagine getting out of prison after 20 years and trying to go get a job? Where do you go? Like, I'll walk into McDonald's and go, hey, can I have a job? And they'll say, well, where were you for the last 3 years? What was your employment experience like? What are you going to say? Well, I sold honey buns in you know, Jessup State Prison for the last 20 years. I'm very entrepreneurial. They're not going to take that. They're not going to hire you either. I mean, unless they got some real forward-thinking McDonald's guy, maybe you can get like manual labor jobs. But if you think about it, you get the manual labor job, you get paid some small amount of money. That money goes to rent and food and so on and so forth. You're in kind of the same position as, okay, I'm in prison and I have to do labor, but I've got a bed and three meals and my buddies are here, versus I'm out in the world and I work a manual labor job and I pay for a bed and three meals and so on and so forth. And In Philosopher makes a good point. Yeah, maybe that's more of a social issue than an economic one. Just to be clear, the economic issue is the economic incentive to incarcerate people for long periods of time, which creates the social issue of people who are so acculturated to prison life that they just can't make it in the outside world, or that they don't want to. And it's too overwhelming. And then Dan Stewart says Slavs were taken by Middle Eastern Arabs. Okay, fair enough. I'll have to look more into that. And then Dan Stewart says prisoners doing more than 10 years can't be in federal minimum security camps. Okay, that makes sense. I guess that's why Ross Ulbricht ended up where he did, because he is serving like a couple life sentences, I think, or some ridiculously huge sentence for all of that. And then, of course, we have this that I saw this morning, which is, and this is also from the Associated Press, 11 U.S. mayors commit to develop reparations pilot projects. Now, we've talked a lot before about justice and injustice and the response to injustice and how difficult it really is to create, to try and micromanage justice. And how, frankly, I have to agree with Friedrich Hayek that ultimately what justice looks like is laws that are few, clear, and equal, or few, simple, and equal. A few basic principles that treat everybody basically the same that allow society to function. But we continue, again, to make economic and social issues into racial issues, into really tribe warfare. Political tribal warfare, identity politics, tribal warfare. And so that results in us coming up with stuff like this, saying, oh, I got an idea. We'll give people checks based on oppression from 150 years ago. So Sacramento, California, 11 U.S. mayors from Los Angeles to tiny Tallahassee, Oklahoma, have pledged to pay reparations for slavery to a small group of black residents in their cities, saying their aim is to set an example for the federal government on how a nationwide program could work. The mayors had no details on how much it would cost, who would pay for it, or how people would be chosen. All of those details would be worked out with the help of local commissions comprised of representatives from black-led organizations set up to advise the mayor of each city. But the mayors say they are committed to paying reparations instead of just talking about them. And of course, this brings up a host of issues. Most notably, the who's going to pay for this. Like, if I'm Asian, do I still, like, so you're going to take it out of my tax money? Are we only going to take it out of the tax money of white people? Are we only going to take it out of the tax money of white people who ostensibly had ancestors that could have owned slaves? Or do we just say, oh, no, if you're black, then you get reparations and we just take it from everybody equally? Suppose I am a Nigerian immigrant. Do I have to pay for reparations? Certainly, I don't get the reparations because I'm not a descendant of slaves. But if I'm a Nigerian immigrant, does that mean I have to pay for it? Because one could make the argument that as a person who appears black, I might be subject to the same residual racism as someone who is a descendant of slavery, and so perhaps I do deserve these reparations, and yet I am not myself a descendant of any slaves. What exactly are these reparations supposed to repair? Is it the idea that, oh, if it wasn't for slavery, then black people in the United States would be further along economically, that they would be further along, that they would be richer? Or is the idea that slavery created a legacy of racism that we have to do something to overcome? Because if we're trying to do something to overcome this legacy of racism, then you have to include, ostensibly, these Nigerian immigrants will also be the victims of any racism that's directed against black people as a whole. So perhaps they do deserve reparations. But anyway, just the point being that we keep making issues that are not racial issues into racial issues. But of course, that means that you have to talk about what really is the problem here. And this is actually something that my guest tomorrow and I are going to talk about, because he's really big into studying what he calls the scientific reality of racism. And so he'll talk about things like those blind resume studies where they put Jamal on one resume and then Steve on the other, and Steve gets more callbacks than Jamal. I have not seen any studies on what if you put like Okonkwo, like an African name, on the resume. What kind of response rates do you get? I'd be very curious to see that, to see if this is like racism or like a kind of culturism. It's a very complicated issue. But Chicago's Lori Lightfoot, who was received a little bit of attention, not all of it great, for very publicly promising to give interviews to only black or brown journalists, now says that racism is a public health crisis and has allocated more than $9 million in COVID funds to address it. Hello, do you speak Trump? Welcome to the stream. So this is very interesting. There's two layers here, right? The first is this idea that racism is a health crisis. And from my perspective, you really got to do some mental gymnastics to get from, oh, people are racist, to health outcomes. And now I know, for example, that my tomorrow's guest, Manuel Galvan, has talked, for example, about studies that were done that showed doctors recommending life-saving treatments more often to white people than to black people. But I don't think that that's what Lori Lightfoot is doing here. I don't think we're talking about the same thing here. But then the second layer of this is allocating COVID funds. Funds that were given to her, I believe, either by the state or by the national government to fight COVID. And she's saying, we're going to fight racism with this instead, which to me sounds like economic incentive again. If we declare racism a public health crisis, then we can use health funds on our racism projects. That sounds to me very similar to, hey, if we arrest people, we can lease them out as labor. Now, I've got an economic incentive to find racism anywhere or everywhere. But anyway, let's check the chat here, because Nightmare looks like he's saying something interesting here. So Nightmare says, especially personal opinion, when you think of the mandatory minimums of some crimes, those are completely out of bounds with the harshness. I mean, 30 years, for example, to being caught on weed, like having weed, okay, in states where it's not allowed. And afterwards, what am I going to do? I was in prison, so am I going to live on the street or what? This is extremely problematic, but I don't claim to have any ideas to change this, really. Sorry being late with this text. It took me some time to make right-sounding sentences. Truly a valiant effort, no doubt. And then we got a bunch of people adding stuff here. But I want to address this real quick. There are a couple of ideas that we can put into effect right now. Things like ending the drug war. I mean, maybe that's just me. Maybe it's my anarchist soul. I say, look, if the crime has no victim, or if the victim of the crime is me, then it really shouldn't be a crime. Like, I don't understand why suicide is illegal. Unless you're unless this is a Christian nation and we have to protect people from going to hell. If I decide to kill myself, then I am harming me. And, oh, well, there's a ripple effect. And what about all the people that you affect who are sad? if we use that as a standard, then everything has to be illegal except for the government prescribed proper way to live your life, because every decision I make affects other people. But if I do drugs, the victim is me. And so really, that's up to me. That should be up to me. And we can knock like 20% off of the prison population just by getting rid of these drug crimes. Just by saying, we're not going to worry about this so much anymore. That's a true public health crisis. If drug use is out of control, that's a public health crisis. And let's take the COVID funds and spend it on that. Not on fighting racism. So that would be the idea to change this, really. But then beyond that, there's more to it than just that. And we'll get to this in a second, but I want to read the rest of these comments first. Eat Shit says, if a white man can cook a pizza and a black man can cook a pizza, it doesn't change anything. That's like being mad that your TV is green instead. Well, if my TV was green, I would be mad because I want my TV to show real colors. But I get what you're saying. Now, we don't want to discount, though, the things like what Manuel Galvan talks about, this guy who's coming on tomorrow, where he talks about unfair treatment. Unfair treatment sucks. Unfair treatment should, in an ideal world, go away. But Eat Shit is also right that because there's unfair treatment in the world doesn't mean that, oh, if you're a black man in America, you can't ever accomplish anything. If you're a black man in America, that your main goal should be fighting racism, not making a living for yourself and building a life for yourself and putting money in the bank and getting yourself some property. Because it's a far better life plan to acquire some wealth and stability for yourself than it is to try and go out and fight these very subtle remaining forms of racism. There's a lot of people who can cook pizza, who are a lot of different colors, who can make a living for themselves doing it. And then Do You Speak Trump said, racism is invented for money. People have become rich because of racism. In 2021, we can take advantage of racism on the backs of blacks without even having to feed them in return. Isn't it beautiful? We had to think about the dematerialization of bondage. I think I know what you mean by dematerialization of bondage, but there's definitely people who have figured out how to make money on this. But I still don't want to discount the existence of the real stuff, right? Because I don't really stand to make any money on racism. I just want to know what the truth is, right? And if it turns out, if someone could zap my brain and it turned out that the capital T truth is that the thing I most need to do is check my privilege and try to excise my whiteness and spend all my time apologizing to black people, then unfortunately, I would be disappointed about it, but I would have to do it. However, it seems to me unlikely that that is the case. It seems to me much more likely that it's overblown a little bit, that real racism absolutely exists, that real people are real victims of real racism all the time. But that doesn't mean that racism is the defining factor in anyone's life. Unless you are that specific individual who happened to get arrested by a super racist cop who was just looking to go make some black people miserable, and then you ended up doing 30 years in prison. Okay, your life has been defined by racism, but your life is not characteristic of life in America. And so the people who were talking about a genocide of black people or talking about a war on black people or cops, it's just open hunting season on black people, cops are out hunting black people, all of that is just fantasy land. Just the same as people who frequent some of these alt-right websites talking about a genocide of the white race. But they're both of them have left reality behind. And that speaks to, I think, to a larger point about how ideology separates me from the world. The more ideological I become, the less able I become to see real reality for the way it really is. And if I want to really see the truth, I have to let go of ideology and just look at the world without desires, without trying to fit my grid of how I think the world is on top of it. Because if you think about it, the people in history who have been the biggest problems, who have ended up murdering the most people, causing the biggest economic disasters, have been ideological people. Who were some examples of some ideological people? Crusaders in the Middle Ages. Radical Muslims shortly thereafter and shortly before that, going around conquering everything on behalf of Muhammad. Neoconservatives invading Iraq, torturing people at CIA black sites in Southeastern Asia. Adolf Hitler, Joseph Stalin, Pol Pot, all that whole little coterie of super ideological Marxists who were going to go and institute Marxism in the world. Despite the fact that Marx said the revolution was inevitable, so there really wasn't any reason for them to do that. But anyway, In Philosopher says the reason America's treasurers could buy the Louisiana Purchase, excuse me, I do speak English, I promise. The reason America's treasurers could buy the Louisiana Purchase in 1803 with $15 million from Napoleon, who was broke, was because slavery was in full force, and that was chump change to the upper crust U.S. citizenry. They were immensely wealthy. I'm going to have to look at that one. I'm not familiar with the details of that particular story. So Louisiana was bought with slavery money? Is that what you're telling me? Does that mean... I was under the impression that Napoleon was broke, and so he sold the Louisiana Purchase for chump change, that it was nothing compared to what the value of that territory should have been. And so Jefferson snapped it up because it was a bargain. Louisiana was a bargain basement buy. But, I mean, I suppose you can't get away from the fact that a large portion of the tax income would have been made on the backs of slaves. But there were also people who were not slave owners who were wealthy, who were contributing to the tax base. But then again, I'm not here to, like, say, oh, slavery had no impact. But... Oh, so I guess you're right. I mean, I can't really argue with it. In Philosopher says 15 million. Oh, gotcha. Okay, Eat Shit says of blue. You know, oh, if your TV is green or blue, I see. And then Do You Speak Trump says suddenly having a white phone today is being racist. Did someone call you racist because you had a white phone? I wouldn't take that person too seriously, whoever that was. And then Do You Speak Trump says, on the other hand, there will always exist racism, but the racism of today is made for the money and the formations to be less white. Gotcha. And the people who say there is racism are the Democrats who try to forget their past with the exclusion in the current Republican states. I'm not a huge fan of that argument. Oh, the Democrats were the party of slavery. Because, like, the political situation is so different today that to say that there's, like, some consistent group, some ideologically consistent group within the Democratic Party that's like, oh, we love slavery, we love racism, so on and so forth, that to me is like a Candace Owens argument, and I'm very suspicious of her. I get what you're saying, and it is a nice little way to dunk on people if you're trying to win an argument, but I don't know that I would want to base my worldview on that argument or say, no, you don't, like, when I'm going to sleep at night, the reason I feel right in my head is because I'm not a Democrat and the Democrats are the party of slavery. That, to me, seems like very shaky ground. Maybe not a great idea. You're absolutely right that there are people who make money and make careers off of seeing racism everywhere. If all you've got is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. If all you've got is, oh my God, racism, then everything looks like racism. So, yeah. I am concerned about this white phone thing. I'm scared for you if people are telling you that you're racist because you have a white phone. So, I don't know about that. That seems iffy. But anyway... So that, actually, no, that does not bring us to the end of our show for the day, even though I am running out of my material. We got just about everything. I have one more article I want to look at that is pretty dang astounding. But Nightmare says, at this point of time, the main income for the states were tariffs, as far as I know. So there could be some kind of truth behind slavery having a part in financing the Louisiana Purchase. But the biggest part is that it was extremely cheap. For the size. You are absolutely right. It was extremely cheap for the size and, as it turns out, for the value of that land, which is very fertile. But yeah, so, but we'll figure that out. I'll look it up later and figure out what the truth is here. So this is the last thing I want to look at here. And this to me is just like the 1-2 punch against the idea that criminal justice is just a black and brown people issue. It's not. This comes to us from USA Today, and the headline is, "Sorry, Harvard, fathers still matter, including black fathers," with a nice little lovely cartoon here. So the culture wars over family structure that raged in the 20th century, wars over single parenthood, marriage, and the importance of fathers, seemed to have ended in the early 21st century. From academia to the policy world, most sensible people acknowledged the importance of strong and stable families for kids. Hailing from the ivory tower in 2015, scholars from the Brookings and Princeton reported on the new scientific consensus. Quote, "Most scholars agree that children raised by two biological parents in a stable marriage do better than children in other family forms across a wide range of outcomes." And this is like, you just can't dispute this. This is just, the science is settled, to use a very suspect phrase, because I am hilarious and ironic. But yeah, it's, the evidence is pretty strong that this is the case. In the public square, the consensus view about the importance of fathers was best articulated by Barack Obama in speeches at churches and colleges across the country. He underlined the value of fathers for kids and his own dedication to breaking the cycle of fatherlessness he experienced as a boy. "And so my whole life, I've tried to be for Michelle and my girls what my father was not for my mother and me." This is Obama speaking. "I want to break that cycle where a father is not at home, where a father is not helping to raise that son or daughter. I want to be a better father." Now, then we get to hit this very interesting part right here, the myth of the two-parent home. So now progressives are calling into question even the kids benefit from fathers argument that Obama made so powerfully. Obama is too conservative these days. This month, for instance, the Harvard Gazette ran an article entitled, quote, "Why Living in a Two-Parent Home Isn't a Cure-All for Black Students." Written by Harvard sociologist Christina Cross, it spotlights her research showing that poor black kids with two parents do not do better on a few educational outcomes compared to their peers with single parents. Which is frankly shocking, because everything that I've seen from both left and right has agreed that kids from two-parent households do better. Even the left-wing ones. I had an article on here a few months ago from the American Prospect, which is a borderline socialist magazine, saying we cannot deny the positive impact of having two parents in the house. You cannot deny the positive impact of the father on the child's well-being, especially for young boys who need to be slapped around a little bit, whether you mean that literally or psychologically slapped around. You need it. It's important. Cross's article echoed themes from an earlier article, quote, "The Myth of the Two-Parent Home," that she published in the New York Times, that claimed living apart from a biological parent does not carry the same cost for black youths as for their white peers. This is the same psychosis we've been talking about this whole time, that everything is all about which tribe you're a member of. And it's just not true. As it turns out, and it says this later in the article, but I don't want to sit here and just read this whole thing. As it says later in the article, a white kid, a white male from a single parent household ends up with a greater chance of ending up in the criminal justice system than a black kid, a black male from a two-parent household. So criminal justice, if we're going to call it an anything problem, is a single parenthood problem, not a race problem. Single parenthood is a better predictor of interactions with the criminal justice system than is race. And by the way, we are not just the only country in the world, or not just the country in the world with the greatest prison population. We're also the country in the world with the highest rate of single parenthood. The UK is close behind. But we win. We are the land of the free, the home of the brave, and the international hub of single parent households. Let's take a look at the chat. In Philosopher says, no one can doubt that in Alaska too. All right, we'll talk about that some other time. Do you speak Trump? Says, so are you a Republican or a Democrat or a Libertarian? Well, I recently did a segment on this show about how I'm leaving ideology behind and being a member of a party is the best way not to see things clearly. So I consider myself a philosopher, though to give you what you're really, I know you're looking for, I'm most of the time sympathize with libertarians. But it's not that I am a libertarian. I'm not going to sit around and read libertarian ideology. Most of the time, and primarily for spiritual and philosophical reasons, I feel like people are best left to their own devices. That order among humans naturally arises out of chaos, and that trying to interfere in general with people from a government perspective by pointing guns at people most of the time ends with unintended consequences. But I also recognize that there are certain patterns of life. There are certain decisions. There are certain cultural makeups that tend to leave people happier, more materially successful, so on and so forth. And so I encourage people to try to live by those principles. I encourage people to investigate what sorts of values they can hold that are going to have the best results for them. And those are very often not profligacy, rampant drug use, eating whatever you feel like on a particular moment, like get some exercise, get some discipline, do some homework, get yourself an education, work really hard. These basic principles, I think, lead people to ultimately be happier and just better off in every metric that you can come up with. And so I push that. I think nowadays we call that being a conservative, like a cultural conservative. But again, I'm not trying to like spread any particular ideology here. What I want is the truth. And if it turns out that reality has a leftward bias, as somebody said, then okay, I'll join the left. But for right now, I don't think so. Especially as the left moves further and further and further left into a kind of like sociological hell. The left was a lot more palatable 20 years ago. In fact, 20 years ago, I probably would have been a leftist. Because 20 years ago, they were like, we got to invade Afghanistan. We got to invade Iraq. And I was not into that either. And then Fudge Your Feeling 7911 says, Juneteenth is BS and just a holiday for weak people. Weak people? Not sure what you mean by that. But I'll make the point again. I made this point before, but I'll make it again one last time. That Juneteenth represents, to my way of thinking, a victory. A great step forward for humanity as a whole, and for America especially. We really solved a huge problem that was kind of inherent in our Constitution and the Declaration of Independence. We said all men are created equal, except for these people. And then we solved it. We resolved it. We said, okay, well, we're not going to have a special legal category for slaves. We're getting rid of it. They're citizens now. And it's been a fight to achieve what, because we all have different versions of what equality looks like. But it was a step forward. And to my way of thinking, it deserves a place alongside July 4th. That those two holidays together, you got the July 4th, which is the first American Revolution, and then Juneteenth, which is the second American Revolution, the Civil War, that really fulfilled the promise of the first American Revolution. It just took us a while. But hey, that's just my take, you know? I recognize where you're coming from. A couple of people have pointed this out in the chat that Juneteenth, it's gonna, like, it has like this political thing now. Like, oh, if you like Juneteenth, then that means that you have to support reparations and critical race theory and the social thing that goes by the name critical race theory, but is not actually critical race theory. It's more like racialism pushed by Ibram Kendi. Like, Ibram Kendi's not actually a critical race theory guy, right? Critical race theory is a narrow legal theory for interpreting laws. The stuff they teach in schools is more like the 1619 Project, which while very iffy and dodgy and not something that I would want my kids learning, technically is not critical race theory. But anyway. And then Lavender Gunner says, ladies, are any of y'all hype for the NYC mayoral race? Well, I will say this. After June 22nd, when they do the primary, I'm doing my best to get Paperboy Prince, who's running, on this show. I think that we are just exciting enough, and he is just cool enough that he may actually make it. But beyond that, the only comment I have on the NYC mayoral race is that it seems like they're trying to elect another Rudy Giuliani. Because crime, I guess, has gotten out of control in New York City. Crime has gotten out of control in every major city, to the point that Buckhead, which is a very wealthy district in Atlanta, right down the street from me, they're trying to secede from Atlanta and form their own city, Buckhead City, because they say Atlanta won't enforce the law. And these formerly very ritzy neighborhoods now have shootings and people robbing cars or breaking into cars and stealing cars and all sorts of other things. So that seems like that's the direction New York is going to go, because people are tired of seeing videos of people getting attacked on the subway, so on and so forth. So that is that. All right, well, that brings us to the end of our show for today, because my voice is giving out and that's all the material I had lined up. So we will be back tomorrow at 4 p.m. New York Eastern Standard Time to talk with Manuel Galvan, who is a PhD candidate at UNC Chapel Hill, who's going to be talking more about racism and inequality in the United States. And we will be challenging him on all of his viewpoints, because he's very liberal. And I don't know what I am, non-ideological. So he will be back. And then the following week, we have John Wendell Ames, the author of How Liberty Can Get Us Out of the Mess We're In. Liberty to the Rescue is the name of the book. So come back next week. We will be here starting every Saturday at 2 p.m. Eastern New York Standard Time until 5 o'clock. And thank you for watching. I'm Patrick Cunningham, and this has been another episode of Socratic Citizen.